Well, when I first entered the house here, I also, as Maharaj mentioned, I also felt that I've been here before. But I knew I hadn't been here before, because the institute building that I visited earlier was in the city. And but the feeling was the same. As soon as I walked in, I was struck by how first class everything was. You know, the color, the paint on the walls, the artwork and frames, the furniture, and in the temple room, the deities, the beauty of the worship and the devotion. And more than any of those, the devotees who greeted us were so first class in their mood of service, their intelligence, their confidence, their devotion. And I thought of an example that Srila Prabhupada gave, that there may be different leaves on a tree. There may be different branches and different leaves on different branches. But when you take the juice out and taste it, the taste is the same. So, although this is not the same building, but the flavor is the same. Now, Srila Prabhupada gave the example in relation to parampara. Parampara is a most important concept in receiving transcendental knowledge. Parampara means literally one after the other. And as stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, evam parampara. That this knowledge was received through parampara. And in that way it was understood. But each recipient of the knowledge will present the same philosophy in different terms according to the audience. But when you extract the juice, you find that the flavor is the same. I was reading this book. His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami left many wonderful books, series of books. There's Leadership for the Age of Higher Consciousness. And that's a series on leadership. And then there's Spiritual Warrior series, which is about being warriors and overcoming the obstacles that may come in the way of Krishna consciousness. And there's the Beggar series, in which His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Swami presents himself in the mood that we all must be in to receive mercy from our superiors, and that is the mood of a beggar. Beggars are by nature, or yeah, a genuine beggar is by definition humble. When we first came to Bombay with Srila Prabhupada, one family came forward, a lady and her two brothers. They were married. She never married. She was very, quite pure. And, you know, she said to Srila Prabhupada that, "I have ideas by which your disciples can get money without having to go out and beg." And Srila Prabhupada replied, "I want them to go out and beg, because that will make them humble. That will dismantle their false egos." So that's really the mood of a candidate to receive mercy from those who have it. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami wrote that series, the Beggar series. And then another series called Reflections on Sacred Teachings. And these are, as the title suggests, his reflections on teachings of the scriptures and our tradition and the teachers in our tradition. So this book has his reflections on 64 principles of community from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, who was our Srila Prabhupada's guru. And he actually, his father, he, his followers, they all presented the message in a way that was suitable for the particular climate and audience that they were addressing. Now, when I first visited the Institute House in the city, I was totally impressed, as I mentioned. And afterwards, Bhakti Tirtha Swami invited Tamal Krishna Goswami and me. We had come together upstairs to talk. And he said that he had students in the Institute that were chanting 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra on beads and following the four regulative principles: no eating meat, fish or eggs, no taking of intoxicants, no indulging in illicit sex, and no gambling, and rendering service for months, and some perhaps for years, without knowing that such a thing as the Hare Krishna movement existed. So I thought, this is quite an achievement. this is quite an achievement. And I think of this especially staying with Deva Prastaprabhu, who has a beautiful painting of Srila Prabhupada in Hippie Hill in San Francisco, like preaching to all sorts of wildly dressed and perhaps even more wildly in their minds than we could imagine. And to do that is extraordinary. To just go alone to a completely different place without any financial or institutional support is extraordinary. No one, I think, other than Srila Prabhupada could do that. I mean, no one did, and no one ever will. But in a way, within that larger context of coming to America, and Srila Prabhupada visited every continent except Antarctica, as far as I know. But his books weren't there. But within that broader context, there are pockets where no one has gone. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami went into those pockets. And touched people that our regular methods of preaching would not have reached. And he was ready to do anything. He had so much care and compassion and also conviction and courage. He was ready to go anywhere and do anything. Remember Ekavira Prabhu telling me the story of how he came in touch with Bhakti Tirtha Swami. Somehow he felt it wasn't the time for him to be in his car. I think he was supposed to be at work. Somehow he felt drawn to his car and turned on the radio. And there was, a black preacher who was interviewing Bhakti Tirtha Swami. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami had been a child evangelist. I mean, he was very God-conscious from the beginning. His mother was very pious. And so the interviewer was asking him, why did you become a Hare Krishna? You know, with your background, why did you become a Hare Krishna? And he said, I'm no more a Hare Krishna than you are. I didn't decide to become a Hare Krishna, but I was looking for genuine knowledge of God and a genuine way of approaching God and serving God. And to date, this is the best I've found. You know, if I found it in the Boy Scouts, I would have become a Boy Scout. But I just happened to find it here. So that was his move to like experience the essence and share with others the essence. And as far as the external dress or frills, that could be adjusted to make it easier for people to accept and appreciate. I spent a lot of time in South Africa, and in this after Prabhupada left, we opened a very big temple in Durban, Shri Radharadhanath Temple. And at that time, South Africa was in the apartheid system. And so we wanted to invite leaders from all the different communities, which we did, But we also wanted a speaker from every community, and although we did have African body devotees then, we didn't really have someone of that caliber. So we invited Bhakti Tirtha Swami. And I was deputed to receive him when he arrived in the temple. And when he came, he was wearing a Nehru jacket, a sort of like Indian style jacket, and a sort of African hat. And I thought, like, wow, this is amazing. I never saw anyone dressed like that. But it was actually very appropriate, because that was like our theme, like Africa, India, black, white, red, yellow. But he was effulgent. I mean, that was most striking. And from then, Nelson Mandela was in prison. But the most prominent African in Southern Africa was Chief Buthelezi. He was like the head of the Zulu nation. So he came, and Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he really, as others have commented, he really could relate to anyone because he was transcendental. He didn't identify with the body. One god sister told me that she had the opportunity to be with Bhakti Tirtha Swami in North Carolina. And she came to her friend's house where he was staying, and she chanted japa with him. And while he was chanting, she just had this feeling that he was in Vrindavan and that he was in very deep communion with Rupa Goswami, like the principal disciple of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is very important for us. And then, after chanting for a while, he said he was going to go for his walk. And she, being in a woman's body, had never gone on a morning walk with Srila Prabhupada. Or if she had, she was sort of on the outskirts and maybe couldn't hear any conversation. So she asked if she could come with him. And he looked at her and said, yes, you can. And the way he said it, she felt that he's completely liberated. He has no bodily identification. So then she told him about her experience chanting japa with him. And he said, anyone can have that experience chanting japa if you immerse yourself fully in the holy name. You give yourself fully to the holy name. In the same mood of Vrindavan, the same mood of selfless service and desire to please Krishna, with no other consideration. So, you know, years passed, and she only had one other chance to associate with him, really, was when he came to Alachua, and he was dealing with depression. He had a large group, and I think depression is, I'm not like so good with statistics like he was, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that suffer from depression and anxiety. And even devotees can, although they have spiritual knowledge and practices, but they can also be affected by that. In fact, there was one disciple of Srila Prabhupada's who came to Juhu, Bombay, and was engaged in service there. And she went, I don't know if went is the right word, but she went into a psychotic state. And I don't even know, like, what terminology is current now. But something like schizophrenic, I mean, very extreme. She felt that people were trying to poison her, so she would like go through, rummage through the garbage looking for food that she felt wasn't like poisoned to kill her and different things. And her father was quite a prominent man. She was from an Indian family and he was a lawyer by profession and a diplomat. He had been India's ambassador to different European countries. So he wanted to put her in a psychiatric hospital, take her for some sort of psychiatric treatment. And we didn't know what to do. So I asked Srila Prabhupada to explain the situation. I mentioned her name. And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, I know her. She's a devotee. And just as you can be a devotee and have a broken arm, and then you take it to a doctor to be fixed. So similarly, you can be a devotee and like have a broken mind and go to a doctor to get it fixed. So Bhakti Tirtha Swami, he was conducting a seminar retreat about related to depression. And he said one of the main factors in depression is loneliness, the feeling that one is alone. And then he said that he led the devotees through a guided meditation on the Lord in the heart. Because according to Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Patanjali Yoga Sutras, the Lord is in the heart. He's outside also, but also inside. And he gave a very vivid description of the Lord in the heart, his curling black hair, his lotus eyes, his enchanting smile, and his mood of love and care for his devotees. And he was saying that you can, you know, he's your best friend. He's a better friend than anyone else could ever be. And he's right inside of you. So where's the question of being alone? And when he brought the devotees out of their meditation and they opened their eyes and looked around, every single devotee saw that every other devotee was weeping, crying, out of whatever relief, or release of emotion, or gratitude and joy that their best friend was right inside of them, right in their heart, and he was available to them whenever they wanted, whenever they chose to access him. So she said these were the only two times that she really associated with him. And then she got the news that he'd left. And she was so devastated. She herself didn't expect it. She felt, she didn't realize how attached to him she was or how much he meant to her in her spiritual life. She was like devastated. And she was crying and crying and crying for days. And nothing could console her. And then he appeared to her. And he said, Remember that time we were chanting japa together in North Carolina? Remember what I said? I said that anyone can have that same experience if you give yourself fully to the holy name in the mood of devotion. So you should do that. And you will be in Vrindavan. And she took that as a very profound and relevant instruction for her. And she was also, as she described it, going through that phase that many devotees go through of thinking, what's the use of pulling on in America? Maybe I should just wind things up here and move to Vrindavan. So she was also going through that contemplation. And that, but after that reconfirmation of the first instruction, she felt, I can be in Vrindavan right here. So, so this is another very important theme in Bhakti Tirtha Swami's life and in his teachings, which is that we should go deep in our sadhana. And in his last days, I was having some communication with him. I, at the time, was unable to travel myself because of my health, so I couldn't come personally. But I spoke with him on the phone, and then when that was hard, we did email, and then eventually that also stopped. But he wrote me one letter in which he emphasized this point of offenseless chanting, because he was so much in the mood of caring for devotees. And at the time I was taking up a project of a hospice in Vrindavan. And he encouraged it, and you know, I asked, what can I do? And he said, you're doing it. But he added that, at the same time, you should go very deep in your spiritual practices. And he quoted Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur that the natural result of offenseless chanting of the holy name is that one will feel compassion for all souls. And that mood of compassion will exhibit itself or manifest itself in the effort to protect devotees, as he said, to protect their devotional creepers. And in creating projects that will achieve that. So, I was hoping that by coming here, I would get his mercy to go deeper in my chanting. And also, and I, you know, as Maharaj said when we walked into His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami's quarters, like, this is the best place to chant. If I get a chance later, I'm going to come out, come up there and be in japa heaven. So yeah, but even that, so much depends on association. It really helps. to chant and hear an association. When we were in South Africa together at the Radharadhanath temple, after Tulsi Puja, we would both sort of rush to Prabhupada's Vyasasan, where that beautiful life-sized Murti of Srila Prabhupada from Lochandas was there. And it was sort of like, not a competition, but a question, who would get there first? And later when Purusha Shukta Prabhu began his spiritual care initiative for devotees and began the japa retreats, I asked him whether he had ever discussed with Bhakti Tirtha Swami what was his mood while chanting japa. And Bhakti Tirtha Swami said, I always like to chant near Srila Prabhupada's Vyasasan. Mm-hmm. And my prayer is that he will kick me in the head with his lotus feet. And I thought, also, that's what it was. And I think that's also, that's the same mood of Bhakti Tirtha Swami, whatever it takes, you know. My dear spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, whatever it takes to make me a better instrument of your will, whatever it takes to make me a better servant of the devotees and of the public, do it. Kick me in the head, you know. Wake me up. Do whatever it takes. And that was his mood. So I also... I think I'm also going to go up. I'm going to pray for two kicks, one from Srila Prabhupada, one from Bhakti Tirtha Swami. But yeah, I really am just like, I feel like I'm floating in a pool of nectar here with all of you sincere devotees and servants of Maharaj and Srila Prabhupada. And yeah, I'm sure that this association will keep me afloat, and it will bring many more souls to the Krishna consciousness. One other thing he told me at the end was that in Kali Yuga, you can never give enough to the devotees. Mm-hmm. Meaning that they just need so much. And so I think of that as well. And that was also Srila Prabhupada's mood. He said, we have to shed gallons of blood to make one devotee. And then after we make a devotee, we have to maintain the devotee. That's even more important than trying to make more new devotees. So that mood of selfless service and care, especially as a natural expression of the compassion one feels within one's heart when one actually is able to relish association with the holy name and with the previous acharyas through their writings, that's really a perfect combination. And I'm sure that that's going on, and that's why anyone who walks in here feels that tangible atmosphere of, like, based on internal spiritual practices, which means association with Krishna and the parampara, and the expression of that love and care through wonderful arrangements to welcome and encourage people. So, yeah, I'm indebted to all of you who are maintaining this exactly as it was, same mood, same quality. Yeah, I'm sure you'll continue, and those who come in touch with you will also similarly be touched, and they'll also contribute to the same effort, and will be able to have that same, the same taste, all the different leaves on the tree, but we'll get the same taste from all of them. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Are you stretching or raising your hand?
Do you allow some questions?
I will. Yes. Yes.
I guess a question that I have is, as ISKCON, the movement of Srila Prabhupada, the Hare Krishna movement, as it grows, as it expands, it includes more and more diverse kinds of people with many diverse opinions. And I guess my question to you is, how do we harmonize, how do we continue to expand the movement so that it really can be a home for every creature, every entity in this world, and at the same time find that harmony and cooperation with such a diversity of people.
Well, what I'm going to say, of course, doesn't affect the question, but just the framing of the question. When I look at that picture of Srila Prabhupada on Hippie Hill with all those diverse people, they're pretty diverse. They're pretty diverse. And I think there's certain basic philosophies that come up again and again, which are really based on the envy of the living entity towards Krishna. They come up with all sorts of philosophies really based on their envy of Krishna, their rebelliousness against Krishna. And, it could be, I'm God, you're God, everyone is God. God is loitering in the street. God is the poor people. You should serve the poor people. By serving the poor people, you're serving God. I mean, and in this one talk I heard when Srila Prabhupada was speaking in this vein, and he was saying how there are people who don't like our strictness in our principles. And he mentioned one lady, disciple of his. He said, she was always approaching me. You know, can't you relax the principles? You know, why do the principles have to be so strict? And finally, after so many repeated interactions with her, he said, I'm sorry, but these are our principles. If you don't like them, you can go somewhere else. But these are our principles, and you can't change them. Those are for initiated disciples. But as far as harmonizing all the diversity, Prabhupada said that's our challenge, unity and diversity. So the GBC should meet every year and discuss how to achieve unity and diversity. And it seems like the holy name is the best. The best way. But this was just like an introduction to the answer. Now I'll ask you to give the answer.
I just call it carbon copy his answer. And just say that we have to have a particular mood to enter. Mm. And as Mara said, that we have our product, Krishna consciousness, and you can choose if you want Prabhupada or something else. It's your choice. We can't change. Mm. We can adjust. We can't change principle.
I'm thinking of Raja Leela when she first came to Washington to meet Bhakti Tirtha Swami with her boyfriend. One of the first things Bhakti Tirtha Swami said to her was, "Are you married?" And at that time, as she describes it, she didn't believe in the institution of marriage. And within her mind, she was already like putting up her weapons, you know. And she was thinking, he's not going to tell me to get married now, is he? And then he said, "You should get married." But he said it with such genuine care and compassion and love, without any false ego of being on a trip. She accepted it. She accepted it. She knew that he genuinely cared for her. And he was thinking of what was best for her. So, although this is again a personal, a personal approach, what I'm going to say is that, in the last weeks, I went to a family's home, Indian family's home. Very nice, very devotional, and at a certain stage, the hostess's mother, you know, a pious elderly Indian lady who was visiting with her, started saying how, well, whatever, hearing Krishna's food, and Krishna was appearing to her and giving her darshan, and I didn't know what to say. So I just prayed to Srila Prabhupada. And I got the answer, just listen and just encourage her. And I'll be the one to chastise her. So then I immediately said, "Have you read Srila Prabhupada's books?" And then we sort of made an agreement that she would read Srila Prabhupada's books. So that's another point. Sometimes I think, it's not appropriate for me to call them fools and rascals, but I'll give them Srila Prabhupada's books, and I'll let him call them fools and rascals. But I think we have to be ready to give them Srila Prabhupada's books. If we hold back on giving them Srila Prabhupada's books because we feel they might be too heavy or politically incorrect or something, I mean, there could be exceptions, I'm not saying that, but I think that's a warning sign. And I've discussed this with many devotees, including Devamrita Swami, who's been very successful in attracting new people. He has, like Bhakti Tirtha Swami, like other preachers, he has modified the presentation, the format, to make it more accessible to people, but he always promotes Srila Prabhupada's books. And he said it's not just for them, but it's for us. We have to have that faith in Prabhupada's book. If we don't, then we could be in trouble. So I think, you know, I think in that way, face to face, we can be congenial. We don't have to, like, say everything that's in the books. But at some stage, we have to give them the books because they have to. Someone has to call them fools and rascals. I mean, that's sort of a joke, but they need to hear the truth. They need to hear the truth. And the truth has... It's one of the main themes of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that it's not enough just to say the positive, you should do this, but you have to say the negative. You know, you shouldn't. And people may not like it because it may interfere with their plans to be God, supreme enjoyer, controller, possessor. But again, I guess we, each of us, can have our own style. I mean, that's there too, but the books are the basis. Like Maharaj said, utility is the principle, and preaching is the essence. The books are the basis. And
purity is the force. Huh?
Purity is the force, yeah. So, yeah, that's like the complete package. I don't know if that really answered your question, but yes.
You know, you're talking about the readings, and for me, for being a friend of the Ugly Hawkins here, to me it's more the practice, you know? Like, for example, the food, even though if I was vegetarian, the way that they, you know, before they, I assume the ritual of being clean before cooking, or having in my mind good thoughts and good things just by watching.
Yeah.
The fact that when in a problem or in things that my family goes, I always can come with a friendship, even if I don't follow the Hare Krishna process. You know, it is always this well-being that it comes with them, you know? So it is that example that it always makes me look towards them, you know? Feel like I can count, I can trust them. You know, I'm not a Hare Krishna, but I say, maybe I am, because I really like that, you know? I like, it's a friendship I never want to miss, even if the children go to different areas of the world. You know, it's that holding of something bigger than me, you know, that they bring something, and it's to see that example that you want to follow, that you want to feel like.
Yeah, that's wonderful. The bhakti in their hearts pervades everything they do, and their whole space. Yeah, even if you don't know the philosophy or don't even agree with all of it, it doesn't even matter anyway. In fact, it reminds me the first devotee I ever spoke to is Gauravani Prabhu's father, Bharadraj Prabhu. And the first time I saw Prabhupada outside of the temple, he was like in a room like this with disciples, and I was like very new. And I walked in, I felt that same like mood of like so much love and care and affection. And later, I And he was there. And I asked him, I sort of mentioned the feeling I got. And he said he had the same feeling. And the realization he had was that Krishna consciousness is just love masquerading as a philosophy. So yeah, you tapped into that love, and that is the essence.
Maharaj, Hare Krishna. You mentioned about going deeper, the need to go deeper in our spiritual practice, and you also mentioned about that we need to try to give and live our lives for Krishna. With material nature pulling me always and in every single direction, and me always being so willing to go, how can I go deeper in my spiritual practice?
Well, you know, association is really most important. And if you just, I mean, that's how I feel about myself. If I just stay in good association, that will do the rest. So it's hard to directly control the mind and senses. But the one thing we can do is choose our association. And just try to stay with association that's favorable to your ultimate well-being. Like, you know, Bhakti Tirtha Swami said that by offenseless chanting, the mood of compassion and care for others awakens. But then that should be expressed first and foremost in helping them spiritually, helping them in the way that will endure. We also help them on other levels, you know, emotionally, medically, but helping them spiritually is the best way of helping them. So, yeah, we want to try to stay in that association as much as we can.
I was thinking that we, like Mara said, we have a choice whom we associate with. And we also have a choice of how to set up our space. So if our space is set up with the idea that this is, like we were talking, Japa Heaven, you know, like every time I go someplace, I make a little area, and that's Japa Heaven. And you, when you come in that area, there's no talking. whenever we look at each other, we want to talk, then we say, Vacho Vegam Manasakura Vegam, which means one can control the urge to speak. So it's always there. We look at each other, and one of us will say, Vacho Vegam. And then if we really want to talk, we'll say, okay, no Vacho Vegam. But it has to be something very serious to get to that point. So we have that choice to set up our environment. And if we do it in such a way, just like she gave the example that when she comes to this house, then the invitation is there to be elevated spiritually, even willingly or unwillingly, you know, or wanting or not wanting. So if we make our space in such a way that when we enter it, it lifts us up, you know. And I remember there was one lecture where Srila Prabhupada gave the example that in the Christian tradition they have 10 commandments. And in our tradition we have 4 regulative principles. So they're the same thing, to elevate one to the mode of goodness. Because on that platform, one has the ability to understand spiritual knowledge and to, you know, grasp spiritual knowledge and to implement that knowledge which we've been given. So rather than make one space half and half or three quarters and one quarter, make it sacred. Then when you enter that, then you have that shelter, along with the association of those who are also pursuing the path of bhakti or devotion to Krishna. So I would say those two things are
yeah.
You know, our environment, and that environment also includes who's allowed in.
Yes?
Maharaj, I wanted to ask about, you said how it takes a lot of work to make one devotee and to keep a person, the endeavor that it takes to even keep a person. I was thinking about, sometimes we're so caught up in our own struggles, and we don't, I mean, the point of taking care of people as well as making, you know, giving people Krishna consciousness, it just seems such a challenge because, you know, now it's like if you have children, if you're working, if you're trying to incorporate this greater message and take care of each other as well as make new people, you know, bring people to Krishna consciousness, it seems such a, so much to balance there. And I know that living when I lived in the ashram, it was solely like you're completely dedicated to that. But when you have, and now it seems like the movement is more spread out, it's not like everyone's living in the temple anymore. We're working, family, children. So I was wondering if you could just speak about that and you know, finding those balances between trying to do that now when we are so spread out as a community. Community just being very spread out.
Well, doing good for others is good for us. My cousin in Santa Barbara is a family therapist. And he began being very, like, hard-nosed, wanted with scientific evidence. But by reading, he discovered that what helps people practically more than anything else is doing good for others. More than all the other therapies and treatments. And, you know, an easy way of doing it is to give people a book. I mean, 2 days ago, Maharaj and I visited a lot of, like, offices and departments, and you know, he has a big box of the perfection of yoga in his trunk, in the trunk of his car. And it's very easy to give someone a small book. I mean, I'm sure he could design a mantra for you. For us, the mantra is, well, when we're together, my friend and I are swamis. We teach yoga and meditation. But we focus more on the meditation side, the devotional side. And here's a book, you know, we'd like you to have. And everyone appreciates it. And, you know, if they're looking at it, thinking, we say, you know, this helps you to control the mind. And everyone is always disturbed by the mind. And this helps you to pacify the mind and become more calm. And then you're able to, access that inner place within yourself and pray and remember God more easily. So you could probably, you're like a housewife and a mother, or?
I'm a mother, and yeah, I'm also a yoga teacher.
What a setup! What a setup!
Just, I find it very, I meet so many people who are interested, and I try and share Krishna consciousness with them. And I realize that it takes blood and sweat and quality time. And to really take care of people that are coming, I need to bring them to the next level, to bring them to that serious place where they're going to make a commitment. I know what it takes, and I don't have that energy to really like give to people that I feel are coming and are very interested in Krishna consciousness. And I find it very challenging to, like, I see there's such potential, and I see there's so much to be done. That's where I'm coming from.
Why not, you know, direct them to the Potomac Temple or the Institute? Yes.
I have a comment just because I'm sort of a new, you know, aspiring devotee. But it can happen very simply if someone's already inclined to a devotional practice. Hari Kirtanadas, I simply went to one of his mantra meditation workshops in like 2012, spring of 2012, so I went home and I started chanting.
I am also a yoga teacher.
I started chanting. I still have the mala beads that he gave me. I also have another mala beads that I chant on, but I have those same ones that I chanted, and that the transformation starts to happen, the attachment starts to grow, and then that relationship, that you develop that strength within in that relationship, and so you're not 100%, you know, relying on that person that introduced you to the path, but that relationship is so important. But other things start to happen. So having trust and faith in the process too is also good.
Excellent.
I also feel that it's important not to just give up Prabhupada, but to also study his books every day. And I feel that's lacking in our movement these days. People don't tend to listen to Prabhupada's lectures every day. That's still regulatory. And read Prabhupada's books. I think it's so important to do that. And so then you can also, when you give up Prabhupada's books, you have faith in it. You have faith in Prabhupada's message. And I certainly don't want to give out the Bhagavad Gita that's written by someone else. You know, I still want to give out Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita because I felt he didn't do so much to give us Krishna.
Yeah.
I'm just reading his books.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, a devotee was just telling me that his spiritual master, in addition to like chanting 16 rounds and following the four regulated principles, adds a commitment to read Srila Prabhupada's books an hour every day.
Or,
yeah.
That
is essential. That is essential. As Prabhupada said of his books, that distributing my books will keep them happy, and reading my books will keep them.
Maharaj, when you represent Srila Prabhupada in, through his teachings, or I guess when you read something that Prabhupada, do you find it that when Prabhupada talks very harshly about material civilization or about different aspects, how do you, when you are asked to explain that, how do you assimilate the instruction when it's something that it might be hard to accept when you first hear it?
Well, one thing I do is I reread it, because even with his lectures, I usually listen to each one twice, mm-hmm. or sometimes three times or more, because you get so much more out of it each time. And one reason you get more out of it is because the mind that rebelled against certain things, it sort of, you know, is pacified. And it, all right, let's just hear what he's saying. I mean, let's not get upset before even hearing him. And there's like so much. There's so much. And I heard a very interesting talk, a recording of a talk by Tamal Krishna Goswami in Houston, in which he was discussing Bhagavad Gita 18, 151 to 153. And it's a whole list of things, you know, like everything about being clean, about living in a secluded place, reducing one's eating, things that one could dismiss. Well, this is like a different context. This isn't for me. Or one could try to accept it fanatically in a way that doesn't, that isn't practical. So we went through the whole list, and he basically asked the audience, okay, now, how do we deal with this? How do we apply this? You know, like on that point of, I mean, each one is very interesting. Let's say on the point of, you know, eating less. You know, how do we deal with this? What does it mean? And then, you know, then the point came up about eating only Krishna prasad. Well, yeah, everyone agreed, yeah, only Krishna prasad. And then he brought up, and, you know, he knew the community very well. He brought up about eating pizza. Now, he said, okay, now, I know you like to eat pizza. So what do we do with that? You know, how does that fit? And then he said, does Krishna eat pizza in the spiritual world? Are we offering him pizza because we think Krishna will like it or because we'll like it? But then he said, but don't worry. Don't worry. I also eat pizza. I'm not going to give it up. But I will eat pizza only prepared by devotees. And of course, it's easier to call in for it. But I'm not going to give up eating pizza. But I'll eat pizza only prepared by devotees. He was saying it's not that hard. And so, and then he said, if someone asked Srila Prabhupada, and he said, I'm sure somewhere along the line someone must have asked him if there's pizza in the spiritual world, or pasta. And he said, I haven't done a thorough search, but I doubt that Prabhupada would specifically say no. Because Prabhupada's mood was to encourage people in their mood of devotion. And he said, in Italy, they're so attached to eating pasta, if they heard there's no pasta in the spiritual world, they might... So, you know, so that's the main thing. We want to encourage them, but at the same time, we have our principles. And Krishna will accept if it's prepared with devotion by devotees.
One time in Italy, they made a rule, no more pasta. And the devotees freaked out, and they had it hidden all over the temple. It was like contraband, you know, and people were selling it under the table.
Yes, Ram.
It will merge. My question is, sometimes I have some discussions about So we're living in Kali Yuga, and the Yuga Dharma is Harinam Sankirtan. So sometimes I have discussions as to other services are just as important as the physical chanting and dancing. So like, you know, deity worship, cooking, cleaning are just as important as, you know, leading kirtan or playing mridanga. But sometimes it's a little hard to understand for me personally what's the balance between everything, since the Yuga Dharma is Harinam Sankirtan.
Would you like to answer?
You can after you start.
Okay.
You choose.
All service is absolute. It's not that one is higher than another. And but the thing about kirtan is that you don't require any other paraphernalia. With deity worship, you require deities, you require paraphernalia, you require other things. But with kirtan, you don't require anything else. So you can do, you know, kirtaniya sadahari, you can do kirtan all the time. But all the other services are absolute, and you know, the Nectar Devotion says that you can achieve perfection by performing all nine, or any number of them, or even one. If you do even one of the nine perfectly, you can achieve perfection, and the nine include other processes. So I think it should be, the devotees should really have the mood of selfless service. On a morning walk in Juhu, Lokanath Swami asked Srila Prabhupada, why have you prescribed 16 rounds? And Prabhupada said, I haven't prescribed 16 rounds. 16 rounds minimum. And then he said, well, why, you know, what about other devotees? They set another minimum for themselves. And Prabhupada said, that's good. You know, you shouldn't decrease from 16, but you can increase from 16. And then he, or maybe another devotee, said, well, how do we know if we're imitating Haridas Thakur? And Prabhupada said, imitation of a good thing is not bad. You know, if you're imitating Haridas Thakur by chanting more, that's welcome. And then a devotee said, but what if we ask someone to do some service that's needed, and they say they don't want to do it because they're chanting extra rounds? Prabhupada said, oh, they say, I'm too busy to do service. I'm busy imitating Haridas Thakur. He said, that's very bad. So when we chant, we're really praying for service. And if by the grace of the Lord service comes and then we refuse it, it means we're not really chanting in the proper mood of asking for service. So, yeah.
Good complaint. I would just like to add one thing, and that is Harinam and Sankirtan book distribution, that our centers, our bases from which this can happen. So all the things that we do, cleaning, cooking, building, this, that, it's all meant to expand the Harinam and the book distribution. That's, you know, it's a structure for us to implement and distribute the holy name, Shadam, and books.
Can we understand from that it means those activities are also, like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said, Brihat Mardanga, the printing press is Mardanga. So then this deity worship and this cooking and these other activities are part of Purna? Is that a fabrication? Or is
my
that
understanding is that everything, if somebody says, what's your service? I always say I'm a Sankirtan devotee, but I wash the pots. I'm a Sankirtan devotee, but I clean the floor. Because that's our goal, is to give our illusion of consciousness.
That's right.
And there's that story, you know, where in Vrindavan, when if you clean the floor, it's black and white marble. And if you clean Krishna and Balaram, it's also black and white marble. So they're all absolute. One is not, like he said, there's no, distinction, in one sense. In one sense there is, in another sense there is. Even when I go shopping, if I have to go, which is sometimes when I'm on the road, and they always, when you get, when you're in line, and then the cashier's like, how are you? And I'd say, do you really want to know? And then I give him a book. Because this is, you know, their opportunity. They're inviting me. So I said, do you really want to know? You know, I'm a prisoner of birth, death, old age, and disease. And we're looking for the escape route. And it's not artificial. It's actually a fire, and we're trying to get out of it. So here's something to, here's a fire extinguisher. And last summer, I was with Giriraj Swami, and my phone didn't work, I told this story before. And so I had to call AT&T to get them, because it was switching between towers, and my phone was not proper. So the lady had to like readjust it on the computer and make it go to one tower or something. And she says, you have any other questions? I said, actually I have one. I said, I got up this morning, I was looking in the mirror, and I said, I remember I had a 5-year-old body. That one's gone. I had a 10-year-old body. That one's gone. 20, 30, 60. But each and every time, I thought that was me. But how could it be me if it's not there anymore? So if I'm not the body that's changing, I must be something different. So my conclusion is that I'm the conscious observer in the body. So if I'm actually a conscious entity, a personal conscious entity inside, then that where I come from must also be a conscious personal entity. So I'm trying to figure that out. Could you please answer that question? And she said, that's the most amazing thing I've ever heard. I agree with you. But I don't know the answer. It's very interesting. So the basic first instruction of the Gita is mind-blowing to most people. To understand the basic thing and not the body is like it's way beyond what, you know, they can't imagine that. So we have this principle that wherever we go and whoever we meet, we touch them with Krishna. And with my experience is if we have this consciousness, and it's like for years, you know, we're Sankirtan devotees, and in the Bhagavad Gita, 7th chapter, it said out of many thousands among men, one may be interested in spiritual practice, and of thousands of those, one may be serious enough to take something of spiritual knowledge. So I figured it out one day that if I approach one person every 5 minutes, right, that's so many people, and you multiply that times 8 or 10, how many hours you work, and it comes up to like 250 or 350 people. So if you sell more than one book,
every 3 days, Krishna is sending people to you that want to get a book, because the average is you have to get 1,000 people out of 1,000 people to get one person interested. So if you can do more than one a day, you're really, you know, you're breaking all barriers. So, you know, and we would go out and we would distribute like 100 books a day or whatever it is, and we just, you know. So if we're in that mood, then Krishna will supply the people. We experience it this week everywhere we went. You know, everywhere we went, we experienced it. And the one time we didn't have the book with us, we met that man at the rest area.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, "What are you guys, Buddhists? So, and we're Hare Krishnas." He says, "My God, I haven't seen you guys since I was a teenager." And we did, and then we got in the car, and I said, and then we drove down the road a little bit, and we stopped at Bucky's, which is supposed to have the best bathrooms in Texas. And we met the guy again. He goes, "Hare Krishna." And for some reason, we weren't in the right consciousness, and we forgot the book. And after we drove away, we said, "Why didn't we give that guy a book? You know, he was sent by Krishna to us. So we have to do our duty to someone or other, give out Krishna to everybody." Yes. Somehow or another. It's exciting, you know. It's in life.
It is.
If you give a little something. I mean, I buy a case. It's $80 a case for 200 books. So they're like 40 cents each. Yeah. You know, 200. You know, it lasts me like a few weeks, a month, depending on, you know, where I'm at and, you know, where we're going. And, yes, yeah, it's, you know, when and if you tell them that you're a yoga teacher and you're a meditation teacher and that, you know, or whatever you want to say, and they think, "Oh, that's cool. And here's a book on yoga. Or, we're trying to get out of birth and death. Here's a book on escaping birth and death." So many things. And I told Mara, we have to get business cards. Mm-hmm. Things, so that if they have a question, or whenever I was, like when I was in Dallas, and we were going different places, I put Kalachanji's restaurant card in. There's a book marker. Number one vegetarian restaurant in Dallas. Mm-hmm. You know, show up. Just tell the gray-haired Swami.